From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This will be a tough show because it's a tough moment for our country, and it's a moment that feels as though it is on endless replay. One weekend, back-to-back mass shootings, 20 people killed during their Saturday shopping at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. 13 hours later, 9 more people killed outside a popular bar in Dayton, Ohio. Authorities say that the shooter in El Paso was an avowed white supremacist, targeting people of color and immigrants in his rhetoric and his shooting. This hour, On Point, the aftermath of the Texas and Ohio attacks, race and domestic terrorism. Join us. We want to hear from you, your thoughts, especially those from El Paso and Dayton. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from El Paso is Aaron Montes. He's a news reporter at the El Paso Times and also an El Paso native. Aaron Montes, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for coming with us at a time that I'm sure is tough as a reporter and as a person down there. Can you tell us what's new today, what we've learned?
Sure. Well, as far as we've come to understand, this person has been given a capital murder charge. We learned that at the wee hours of yesterday. There have been no major developments yet. We're starting to identify people who have been victims of this shooting. And certainly this community is rattled by what happened this weekend, simply because El Paso is known for its safety and known for being a peaceful place. And so people are still grappling with that, but as things begin to unfold, we'll learn more throughout the day.
We've been hearing about acts of heroism, people shielding loved ones, people helping strangers get to safety in the last 24 hours. You've also been hearing a little bit about how tough this was. I do want to give listeners a warning. This is tough stuff, but I do want to play a clip. One survivor of the El Paso shooting named Maribel Latin spoke with CBS News while recovering in the hospital from 2 gunshot wounds. Latin was outside of the Walmart fundraising with her daughter's soccer team when the gunman arrived.
He shot at us, like, individually, trying to get us individually. And then he came walking towards us to make sure we all got shot again to get killed.
You know, Aaron, authorities have said, the mayor in El Paso, but also law enforcement authorities have said that they have are convinced he's linked to an online, what's been called a manifesto, which indicates some strong anti-immigrant, not just sentiment, but hatred, talking about an invasion by Latinos from the South. Why do authorities seem convinced that this is the case?
Sure. Well, the authorities are trying to confirm whether or not he is, in fact, linked to this particular manifesto. However, they may be thinking that simply because, this man drove from the heart of Texas all the way out to El Paso and chose this particular Walmart, which is one of the busiest in the company in the United States, and also it's one of the busiest businesses in general in this country. It attracts traffic from Chihuahua. A lot of customers come from the northern part, from cities like Juarez, which is really close to El Paso. Mm-hmm. And he must have been very conscious of that, and you know, when you read what appears to be his manifesto, you come to understand that a lot of it, you know, may have been fueled by this anti-immigrant views. A lot of what you'd hear from these groups that detest the growing number of Hispanics in this country and in this state. And just exactly what it means. So that's a little the reason why the police mm-hmm. and the authorities think that it's linked to him.
And Aaron, briefly, could you remind people of, you know, El Paso, the past, remind people of the dual nature of this city and its distinctive blend of American and Mexican identity?
Sure, absolutely. Well, many people in El Paso have family, have friends in Juarez, and travel across the border every single day. Many Juarenses will make their way across the border to go to school, Some will go to work. Some have family here. We all share a language together. We share culture together. This is very much a binational, bicultural area. We all see each other as neighbors. And the reason why something like this hits so hard is because people from both sides of this, from this border, you know, were affected by this weekend's shooting, and that's what's made it so incredibly difficult, you know, for people who live here, because El Pasoans have come to know that, you know, there's going to be violence in Juarez, and we've all kind of learned that and accepted that, but, you know, we all still venture out there anyway just because of how much of a part of it is of our identity. But generally, you know, people who come to El Paso are not expecting to see something like this, and that's what's made it so tragic.
Seven of the 20 who were killed were actually Mexican nationals. Vivid evidence of what you're describing. Aaron Montes, thank you for your work. Thank you for your time, and thank you for sharing your sense of community in this difficult moment. We appreciate it so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Joining me now from Dayton, Ohio, is Jess Mador. She's a reporter for NPR member station WYSO, who has been covering the shooting there and helping to coordinate her station's coverage. Jess, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the events last night and this morning? What more we're learning? What more is transpiring in the community there in Dayton?
Right. Well, first of all, police and a host of agencies that are assisting, including the FBI and the ATF, you know, they're all working to understand what the motive may have been in this attack. They ran down the timeline. They released a ton of information yesterday, including surveillance video, details about the shooter's identity and the victims, et cetera. But what they don't know is more about the motive, and so that seems to be the number one goal as far as the investigation, which is really intense at the moment, as you can imagine. And the response has been emotional, and there was a vigil last night with a massive crowd, and there's been a fund established already to help some of the families affected by this tragedy.
I want to play a little clip from last night's vigil. I think it's an interesting moment. Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio, a longtime leader in that state, spoke at a vigil yesterday in Dayton's Oregon district following the shooting that occurred Sunday morning. And let's be clear, the shooting in Dayton, 9 people were killed, at least 27 others were injured. Some people in the crowd started to shout during DeWine's remarks in protest. Here's what they said.
We are here tonight because we know that we cannot ease the pain of those families who have lost someone. We also know that we want to do something. So what we do tonight...
Jess Mador, do something, people in the crowd are shouting. It seems like a relatively spontaneous reaction of anguish and anger.
I agree. And, you know, yesterday afternoon, there was a press briefing, one of many throughout the day, and Ohio senators, congresspeople, other state representatives, and the governor himself, you know, they came to this briefing and spoke about the need for a bipartisan conversation about mental health and guns. But, you know, there were a lot of thoughts and prayers, few details. And, you know, in Ohio, people here are pretty used to gun legislation failing in the legislature. So it's unclear what might be able to pass, although the governor has expressed support for one bill, a red flag law, which I know some other states have passed, which, as I understand it, would allow a court to confiscate a weapon from someone who may pose a threat. But again, there's nothing imminently passing.
Mm-hmm. We do have a clip as well from one of the witnesses. And again, I warn listeners, this is tough to listen to. Anthony Reynolds was a witness of the shooting there in Dayton. He recounted the scene to NBC News before the network played a recording of the tragedy Reynolds was able to capture on his phone.
We got to the end of the line, which is near the corner. You heard one gunshot. You heard boom. So we looking around, we didn't know what it was. It didn't sound like a familiar sound, and the buildings around here made it kind of echo off. And then you hear a second boom, and then after that it's complete rapid fire.
And indeed, a lot of people praised the quickness of police responding to within 30 or 60 seconds. And yet, you know, in just 30 or 60 seconds before they apprehended and killed or shot the gunman, 9 people were killed and 27 other people were injured. The president earlier today saying that that mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun. You mentioned that Governor DeWine, also a Republican like the president, had focused on mental health. Was that really in some ways what he wanted to limit his focus on?
Well, I can't speak to what he was thinking, but that was certainly the theme at the briefing that included a lot of the state and federal officials from across Ohio. And, you know, as you mentioned, the police explained that this weapon that was used could fire, you know, as many as 100 rounds at once. And it's an AR-15-like assault rifle. So, and they believe that he purchased it online in a legal transaction and then picked it up in Ohio.
This obviously is a story that we're going to be following more this hour and in coming days. Jess Mador, a reporter for member station WYSO, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
President Trump addressing the nation earlier today, saying our nation must act against white supremacy. We're discussing the mass shootings in El Paso, where that seems to be. Authorities say that that is a factor. And also in Dayton, Ohio, where motives are less clear. Please join our conversation on gun violence, racism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, and our nation's response to all of the above. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the mass shootings from this weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. In a moment, we'll be joined by two experts who have been studying gun violence and also how it intersects with domestic terrorism and white supremacy. But first, I'd like to take some callers. We particularly have callers from the area of Dayton, Ohio. Let's start with Nancy, who's calling in. Nancy, share your thoughts at this terrible time.
Well, I was at the vigil last night, and I was one of the voices that rose up and said, do something, yelled, do something, because what happened in Dayton is just unconscionable. You know, this needs to stop. And Governor DeWine has an abysmal record on gun control, and we have 7 pieces of legislation in our state state house right now that are just stuck, and he can do something, and we're just calling out. And I know that people are saying that they're angry that they think that this got politicized, but that's not what this is about. This is the fact that 9 people died, and if people don't think that they're angry that they got killed, they're wrong.
Well, Nancy, just briefly, why is it that you contend that the governor's record is abysmal on this? He obviously says that that he wants things to stop, and he says he wants to do things to address this. Why do you feel his record is not?
One of the first things that he signed into legislation when he became governor was to fill a loophole that strengthened gun access to these kinds of weapons. One of the first things he did. Now he might talk the talk, but he does not walk the walk. And you know he's in a very tough spot because he's got all these people that are pandering to him that are huge gun access NRA people, and he's got to keep his job. You know, when he was in the state house, He got an F rating from the NRA, but when he's or when he yeah or when he was in the Senate, he got an F rating. But when he now that he's governor, you know, he's getting pats on the back. So no, you can't come to this city and talk this talk, and it's just not acceptable to us.
Okay, thank you for that, Nancy. I'd like to take a couple more quick calls now from Dayton. We have Andrew calling in, also from Dayton. Andrew, what are your thoughts?
Hello. Yes. For me, it's just frustrating being someone in the middle, not Republican or Democrat, that regardless of the party affiliations, white nationalism, domestic terrorism, Antifa, we just can't come together. Nobody seems to be able to make an agreement without blaming the NRA, the gun makers, or, you know, something else. We can't seem to ever come to agreement. And someone like me, that's incredibly frustrating. It's Dayton, Ohio is where I grew up. Those bars right along there in the Oregon district are where I'd regularly go out with my wife. So this is home, and it's just frustrating. Everybody just wants to yell and scream and point fingers rather than sit at the table like an adult and actually do something about it.
And if you were to give me, before I let you go, Andrew, a one-sentence thing about before this crisis, how you would felt about gun control or gun regulation, where would you have fallen on the spectrum?
I would have fallen slightly more about the idea of going, let's do common sense gun reform, better background checks, and more pro-red flag laws. I don't want to take everybody's guns away, but we definitely need to be smarter about how we access things.
All right. I want to take one more call from Springfield, Ohio. Mark, you're on the air. Please share your thoughts.
Hello. Yes. We're about 30 miles away from Dayton. My wife and I go to the Oregon District quite often for dinner, and our friends playing bands down there. I watched the visual last night, and Dayton's Congressman Mike Turner was on stage, and he was talking about how shook up he was about his daughters were in the area last night. But when Congress voted on H.R. 8 and H.R. 1112, to vote for enhanced background checks, both he and the congressman from Cincinnati, Warren Davidson, both voted no. Mm-hmm. So if the people in the audience are saying, well, we need change, then let's take a look at our representation, the people that are in Washington, not doing the things that we're asking for.
So you're seeing you want things on a national level, not simply just on a state level for that sort of thing, it sounds like, Mark.
But it's a combination of the two. We've also got a state representative named Kyle Kaler here from Springfield. He posted a video about 6 or 8 months ago. One of his political opponents wrote him a letter. He didn't like it. He posted a video at his gun range shooting up the letter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of mentality that we're seeing here in this area, and no one's really standing up and fighting for us,
all right,
keeping us safe.
All right. Thank you for that, Mark. Mark calling from Springfield, Ohio. I want to point out that Governor Mike DeWine spoke to reporters at a state fair yesterday afternoon, the Ohio State Fair, and he said, we're open to discussion. This is a debate that shouldn't take place and that everything is on the table. We've also put out a call to Governor DeWine, see if he'd be willing to join us for a few minutes this hour. I want to turn now to two people who have thought about these issues quite deeply. Joining us from Berkeley, California, is Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter at The Guardian covering gun policy, criminal justice, and the far right in the United States. Lois Beckett, thanks for coming back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And here in our studio in Boston, we have J.M. Berger, a research fellow at Vox Pol. And it's an organization focused on researching the prevalence and impact of violent online political extremism and responses to it. He's also the author of the book Extremism. I wish we were together for other reasons, but J.M. Berger, thanks for joining us again at On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Lois, let's talk a little bit just first to look more narrowly at an issue that might apply to both, which is the question of gun policy. You heard a number of callers upset, angry. We heard protesters saying to Governor DeWine, do something. What would be effective here to do something? You know, as you've been reporting on things, what things seem to work regardless of where it falls in the ideological spectrum?
So there are two pieces of legislation in Congress right now that are both worthy of a lot of attention right now. One is H.R. 8, which is a bill that would expand background checks to all gun sales, so there would be no longer any private sales between individuals without a background check. And the other is a big bipartisan push, which has support from Senator Lindsey Graham, among others, to institute extreme risk protection orders or incentivize states to pass these laws. And I think that one is worth the most attention because we talk a lot about how hard it should be to get a gun. But extreme risk protection order laws are designed to give family members, law enforcement, sometimes teachers or employers, the ability to go to a judge and make a petition that someone, even if they've already bought their guns, should have those guns taken away because they're a risk to themselves or others. It's very narrowly tailored. It's evidence-based. This is a rare piece of gun policy where it's not only bipartisan with support from both Democrats and Republicans, but it has real science behind it. Mm-hmm. And that is something that could advance in Congress right now. And we'll have to see if it does.
I want to play now remarks that the president made. President Trump was responding to the news of these shootings on a tarmac, particularly in this case. I think he's talking about both, I guess. And he was speaking in Morristown, New Jersey yesterday. One of the things he did was credit law enforcement for acting so quickly.
As bad as it was, it could have been so much worse. I just have to thank them. The job they've done is incredible. They were right on the ball in El Paso. They were there so quickly, and in Dayton in less than a minute. Think of the damage he did in such a short period of time. In less than a minute, the law enforcement acted and killed him.
Lois Beckett, I know I mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but he's absolutely right. Less than a minute, in less than a minute, police took out the believed shooter. And yet 9 people were killed. 27 others were injured. How is it possible to kill so many people in that short a time?
It is really difficult to realize that what we're dealing with in this past week, 3 people dead in Gilroy, 20 in El Paso, 9 in Dayton. Like, this is the best case scenario for America right now. Like, this is when everyone is really trained and working hard and there's good luck and people are standing right there. The good guys with the guns are standing right there. And still more than 30 people dead. You know, there's been a lot of attention to military-style rifles. The New York Post has a cover out today calling for a ban on assault weapons, a ban on weapons of war. It's worth remembering that researchers who study gun policy say that the most important thing to focus on is the capacity of the ammunition magazines, and that this how many rounds you can fire without reloading seems to be the most significant difference between what makes different weapons more dangerous. There's a lot of talk about different features of military-style features of weapons, but larger magazines can also be used on handguns. And it's that more than the type of weapon that experts say deserves the most scrutiny.
That's the voice of Lois Beckett of The Guardian. And as Lois has documented ably, not only are there these incidents, she obviously has written a lot about the fact that most gun deaths do not happen in mass shootings. And yet there seems to be in these cases, Jan Berger, if you look at El Paso anyway, the question of the motivation tying together the notion of hatred with the explosion of violence. I want to play a clip now from Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd. His congressional district borders El Paso. Here's what he had to say yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation.
This is an act of terrorism. Terrorism is an act where you use violence against civilians for a political end. And initial indication suggests that this is based on race and hatred, which would be white nationalist terrorism.
Jan Berger, you were telling me before the show that this is not a close call. Authorities have said that they believe strongly, that they've concluded that an online manifesto posted on the social media platform 8chan, and you can tell us a bit more about 8chan in a moment, but that manifesto is linked to the killer and the killings. Tell us why.
Well, from the open source perspective, what we know is that the manifesto was posted shortly before the killing started. And the post in which it was initially put online included the killer's name. So from an open source perspective, from, you know, the perspective of people without warrants and subpoenas, that's about as sure as you can be that this document is connected to this killer.
So tell us about – there is no criminal charge, as I understand it, for domestic terrorism. right? There's charges for international terrorism that we can – that our federal authorities can bring in federal courts, but we don't have a domestic terrorism charge. What makes this terrorism as opposed to a racist motivation for mass murder?
So there is a little bit of gray area in between a hate crime and terrorism. What terrorism typically seeks to do is that it's a public act of violence that is intended to influence a population. And the manifesto clearly states that he's doing this in order to cause people to think twice about immigrating to the United States. So as far as this being terrorism, it's as open and shut of a case as you can imagine.
It's just right there.
Right. I mean, now there's no legal category of terrorism under which to charge him because our terrorism laws are currently based on membership in foreign terrorist organizations or support for those organizations. So where it gets tricky in terms of having a domestic terrorism law is that if we follow the same template that we used for foreign terrorists, then we have to start designating groups, and then that becomes a – very quickly becomes a political discussion. I think there's probably room to define a domestic terrorism law that is based, you know, on the definition to say that if it's an act of public violence that's intended to intimidate or coerce a population, that you can make a case for that being terrorism without having to necessarily get into a kind of a group designation situation.
And Jane Berger, you know, how active have federal authorities been, particularly in this administration, compared to past ones, in actively seeking to thwart, redress both sentiment that leads to violence and to stave off, inspirations for that violence?
Well, so, you know, in the context of jihadist terrorism, there was a big focus under the Obama administration on countering violent extremism. And mm-hmm. that was intended to try and counter the ideologies that cause people to become terrorists rather than just deal with terrorism as a law enforcement problem. And what we've seen is that those initiatives have really withered under the Trump administration for a couple of reasons. Partly it seems to be just lack of interest. Partly these programs were always controversial and there was always some complications of governments getting into kind of ideological questions. And then explicitly I have heard the DHS Secretary Nielsen before her resignation said something that FBI Director Wray also recently said, which is that they investigate violence, white supremacist violence, and not ideology. So that's a key difference because if you are consuming jihadist ideology online, that is almost always a pretext for somebody to open an investigation on you.
But if you're doing that through Stormfront and other things and explicitly avowing the desire for violence to occur against Latinos, Jews, Muslims, blacks, that is not a pretext for opening an investigation the same way.
If you're on Stormfront, that's not a pretext
right,
for
sure.
investigation. If you are avowing violence, if you are threatening violence, instigating violence, that is a pretext
but
for investigation.
But if you were on a jihadist website, that would be.
Right. If you were in a ISIS Telegram channel, that alone is probably a pretext to open an investigation. Now, there are thousands of people on Stormfront. It's not a practical thing to investigate
sure.
all of them, but the authorities for investigating and monitoring domestic sites like that are much different.
And of course, there's a hangover from the era in which there was concern about the feds being actively involved in investigating people's political beliefs. Lois Beckett, before we conclude this segment, although we're obviously going to continue the discussion after a brief break, I want to ask you what briefly in the minute we have left, what is the, if any, intersection that you see between gun ownership, gun usage, gun violence, and the kinds of white supremacist extreme right sentiment that you've seen evinced in the El Paso shooter's writings?
I think one thing that we don't talk enough about in the gun violence debate is how much racism and white supremacy are baked into the whole controversy and how much gun ownership has been linked with citizenship. We know that African Americans have been denied gun rights. The Black Panthers' decision to parade with guns in public in the California legislature prompted a gun control crackdown. And so it's possible if we talk about how gun ownership and violence are so much the subtext of this whole debate about who gets to be violent, who gets to be armed, who must be disarmed, that might help us actually work towards solutions. questions.
We're discussing this weekend's mass shootings in Texas and in Ohio. Please join our conversation, especially those of you who are in and around El Paso and Dayton. How do we stem a resurgence of white nationalism? How do we unravel this thread of violence? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the mass shootings that have happened over this weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. You can join our conversation. We should talk about gun violence, about racism, white supremacy, about whether authorities should monitor and regulate the dark corners of the internet to prevent violent messages from warping into violent actions. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me today, I have Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter at The Guardian covering gun violence, criminal justice, and the far right. And J.M. Berger. He's a research fellow at Vox Pol who studies the prevalence and impact of violent online political extremism. You know, I want to talk a little bit. There's been a lot of attention about the president's rhetoric. Earlier today, he said a few things. He said, in one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. He also said we must stop the glorification of violence in our society, that we are outraged and sickened by this monstrous evil. We vow to act with urgent resolve. He said that he would be open to proposing some significant new gun control measures if twinned with certain kinds of immigration law changes, which he did not specify. On the other hand, out in public, he has often evinced somewhat different rhetoric. Let me play first a clip from a rally in May in Panama City, Florida, that's gotten much circulation in the past 36 hours. In that rally, President Trump joked about shooting immigrants crossing the border from Mexico. Someone from the crowd actually shouted, "Shoot them," after Trump was speaking of ICE agents' restraint when dealing with illegal immigrants.
We don't let them, and we can't let them use weapons. We can't. Other countries do. We can't. I would never do that. But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement.
As a punchline, the president saying only in the Florida panhandle can you get away with shooting people trying to cross the border. So former U.S. Congressman, current Democratic candidate Beto O'Rourke slammed the press after a question from a reporter about the president's actions. The reporter asked, is there anything in your mind that the president can do now in the wake of the El Paso shootings to make any of this any better? Here's how O'Rourke responded.
What do you think? You know the he's been saying. He's been calling Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. I don't know. Like, members of the press, what the hold on a second. You know, it's these questions that you know the answers to. I mean, connect the dots about what he's been doing in this country. He's not tolerating racism. He's promoting racism. He's not tolerating violence. He's inciting racism and violence in this country.
J.M. Berger, how fair is that charge?
I think it's pretty fair. We are currently engaged in the now familiar ritual in which they drag Trump out to a podium. He reads what's put in front of him. That has a bunch of words that seem like they're in the general neighborhood of what they should be. And by the end of the week, he'll have said something to completely negate that. He'll take it back, either directly take it back or just say something in direct contradiction. The tweet this morning trying to tie immigration reform to gun violence is appalling. I mean, that is, you know, essentially.
And say why you think that's the case.
We're like 2 days after a terrorist attack over immigration, and he's using
seven Mexicans killed
to advance his anti-immigration platform. I mean, it's inconceivable that any president would immediately propose to do something consistent with a terrorist motive days after a terrorist attack. It's shocking.
So let's hear the words that the president said this morning. At that press conference in addressing this, President Trump said he's asked the FBI to use all necessary resources to investigate hate crimes and domestic terrorism in the wake of the shootings this weekend.
In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul.
Why do those words carry no weight for you while the other words do?
Because the other words represent his consistent position over time. What we've seen, what we saw after Charlottesville, we've seen on multiple occasions, is that when there is enough pressure on him from inside the White House or from outside the White House, he will come out and make an effort to be presidential. And what we have seen very consistently is that he will take it back. So, you know, with the center back chants, we saw that pattern repeat itself again. He came out and said, oh, well, I didn't like those chants. And then, you know, 2 days later, he was like, oh, no, those people are all great patriots. So, I mean, this is, you know, it's ritualistic. And I think it's important not to give him credit that he hasn't earned for expressing an honest sentiment.
I want to take a couple of quick calls now. Mark is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Mark, please share your thoughts.
What's that? Hello?
Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Why don't you – you got a lot of listeners here. I'm listening to you. Tell us your thoughts about what you take from this terrible event.
I live in Dayton, Ohio, and frankly, I am afraid now. I used to be a little afraid. The day that the and it was – over a period of 13 hours, but 2 days, the day that the El Paso shooting, I told my wife, it's only a matter of time before it happens here at home. And then later on that evening, it happened at home. I am someone who suffers from mental issues, mm-hmm. and I take proper medication, and I go to therapy. And this type of thing, this type of terrorism works. It doesn't work on everybody. The masculine folks who think that it's just a fight with guns, it's not about that. It's about the terror that it instills in the people that live there day to day. I used to work in the Oregon District, and I wanted to go to the vigil last night, but I couldn't because I was too afraid that someone would come and shoot that up.
Well, Mark, thank you for sharing your thoughts and also, you know, your own awareness of your own circumstances. I appreciate that. We'd like to take a call now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Pat, weigh in here.
So in my, you know, in the first 10, 15, 20 hours of both of these tragedies, as, you know, a conservative Republican, I would be open to some potential gun law changes. And I understand that that always hasn't been the stance of the Republican Party. However, what backs me into my corner again and starts making me defend Republicans and defend the president is the media reaction. I mean, we literally have presidential candidates saying that one man is to blame. One man is racist. And it makes me angry because these shootings have been going on for 15, 20, 25 years. We had a lot of guns in the 80s. I want to talk about some of the real problems. Yes, gun laws is part of that, but what's making us as a society having these people that used to not act out and now they're acting out? Why aren't we talking about some of the broken homes, the breakdown of culture in general? I have a hard time as a human believing that one person is going to somebody's words. I don't care if it's the president. And this has been on both sides. I mean, we had some Congress people almost get shot up by somebody who is a Bernie Sanders voter. From what I've heard, this person in Dayton, his social media is talking all about what quote unquote, you know, left wing agenda. I don't want to talk about that, but it seems like even earlier in this program, we're talking about right wing. It's frustrating. It is frustrating, and it's
so
hard
Pat,
for me.
Pat, let me just jump in here. It sounds to me as though you're frustrated about the fact that it seems aligned. You know, we've talked, and thank you for that call, Pat. We've talked a bit about how there is an intersection between certain kinds of far right extremism and gun violence. Lois Beckett, our caller said this feels unbalanced. I feel as though all conservatives are being attacked when we talk about these issues. How do we disambiguate those things, or are they not entirely separable?
I think it's really worth saying that the white nationalist violence we are seeing in the United States and these acts of terror around the world, in New Zealand, in London, in Canada, are not just about President Trump. They're not about one man. But it is also very important to say that these are political attacks. What we know right now about the El Paso shooter is that he considered the rising number of Hispanic citizens and people in the state of Texas as an invasion. That is precisely the same language that President Trump has used repeatedly when talking about migrants at the southern border, that they are invaders, that they are an invasion. So I think it's important to say that we are not talking about one person's piece of rhetoric somehow being held fully responsible for violence. What we're saying is that this shooter in El Paso appears to have a political agenda about maintaining the status of white people in America and limiting the number of non-white people in America, and that President Trump has repeatedly over the course of his entire candidacy and campaign endorsed a similar political program, has said that America's first black president race conspiracies that he was not a citizen, said he wanted to ban Muslims from entering the United States. So what we're talking about is not that one piece of rhetoric sometimes might have inspired a shooter. We're talking about violent white nationalist terrorists who want similar things, have a similar political agenda of particular politicians. And we're also seeing what President Trump said in the wake of the shooting in El Paso was let's pass some immigration reform and a background check law that would not have been relevant in that case. And that is, as J.M. Berger said earlier, the president advocating in the wake of a terrorist attack, let us give the terrorist what he wanted.
So I want to play because the question of what, you know, Democrats have been more likely in recent decades to push for certain kinds of gun control measures, some of which might have played here in one or other of the cases, some which might not have. But nonetheless, you've been hearing from Republican office holders a little bit more deliberately in the last day. Here's what a few had to say. Let's take first Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. He held a press conference Saturday, the day of the El Paso shooting, and said that the Texas state legislature had passed bill after bill after bill to keep students safe at school after eight teenagers and two teachers had been fatally shot last year at a different mass shooting at Santa Fe High School in Texas. Abbott then went on to say this.
During that time, we did not, as far as I know, evaluate for and plan for an incident like this. That said, I can tell you that perhaps the most profound and agreed upon issue that came out of all of those hearings was the need for the state and for society to do a better job of dealing with challenging mental health-based issues.
According to our researchers, one of the bills Abbott signed into law involved arming more teachers at schools. None of the bills involved increase gun control measures. Additionally, multiple studies suggest that only a third of mass shooters suffered from untreated severe mental illness. I wanted also to play a clip from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who spoke to Fox News and said that video games were in some large part to blame for the mass shootings.
The idea of these video games to dehumanize individuals, to have a game of shooting individuals and others, I've always felt that is a problem for future generations and others. We've watched from studies shown before of what it does to individuals.
And indeed, the president himself earlier today cited violent video games as something to blame for the mass shootings. Lois Beckett, how much stock should we put in that? How much evidence is there to support that claim?
it's not worth spending 1 second talking about video games and violence. This is a real crisis. We have to be serious. I think it's something the conservative caller mentioned earlier, this feeling that, you know, there have been guns in this country for a long time. What is particularly going on now? That's a more important and more valid opinion to explore. And I think it's worth saying that we know that gun homicides overall in this country have been trending down over the last 2 decades, that the gun homicide rate is about 50% what it was in the early 90s. At the same time that we're seeing suicides rising, at the same time we're seeing what feels like an uptick in mass shootings. But overall, fewer people are being murdered with guns in this country than they were 2 decades ago. And that's what's really hard about all of this. What we care about is saving people's lives. We have to acknowledge that this is messy and that there are a lot of different things going on at the same time, and that really making sure that we prevent violence, that we can prevent as many people as possible from being shot, means doing a lot of different things, and often doing things that run against people's instincts of what would be helpful. But I think it's always important in these moments to remind everyone that there are tens of millions of Americans who own guns in this country, and they are afraid in this moment, and they are scared for their kids, and they are horrified at this violence. And a lot of Americans really do sincerely believe that gun control wouldn't make other people safer, and that, in fact, carrying guns is the best way that they can keep the people around them safe. So I think it's more important to lift up the voices of ordinary gun owners in this debate than politicians who apparently haven't even taken the time to get a talking point that is fresher than from the 90s.
Jim Berger, in the minute we have left, you've been very critical of the president today. How much do you feel that the Republican Party may be more willing to address more expressly the concerns you've expressed about race and about focusing on immigrants, people of color, in a violent way as a result of incidents like this? Or given that you feel that the president is doing this to kind of play to his base and wink to voters of a certain kind and passion, do you think that people are along for the ride and not willing to step up?
What I think is that the president's base is not the entirety of the Republican Party, but it's enough of it that standing up to the president puts a Republican seat in danger. So if you are a Republican politician, standing up to the president means potentially losing 20% of your voters. And the question is whether you should stand on principle and do the right thing and condemn the way the president has conducted himself on these issues, even if it's going to cost you your seat. And I think people need to think about that.
And as we've heard from callers, people resent being associated with that kind of violent thought simply by virtue of their partisan affiliation or political vote. You've just been hearing from J.M. Berger, research fellow at Vox Pol. Thank you for joining us so much to talk about extremism in this moment.
Thank you.
And we've also been joined by Lois Beckett of The Guardian, who covers gun policy and the far right in the United States. Thanks, Lois.
Thank you.
You continue the conversation, and you can get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Pulley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from David Marino, Alex Reese, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.